It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Niler 9 podcast. It's myself and Andrea Cleary here, and we're going to be talking about a special topic today. Andrea, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Niall. How are you?
Good. Nice to be back on the pod this week, now that summer is officially over and over. That hot weather is gone. It was actually too hot last week to do anything.
Thank you.
It was too hot.
It was horrible. I was cat sitting for a friend of the show, Carlo. And just thank God they had a fan in their apartment, because I would have melted otherwise. But I was spending the week with a lovely cat, which is lovely.
Yeah.
But too hot.
Certainly not a complaint about the weather for me. I enjoy it, but also it was just, there was points last week where this house that I live in, it was so hot that I was like, I have to leave this house.
Yeah, but then you go outside and it's the same temperature out there. There's nothing you can do except stand by the fridge.
That's it. Exactly. We resorted to putting like little ice cubes on the cat's heads because they don't know how to ask for it, but they're definitely too warm and they're like hiding under the couches and stuff. And you're like, this is gas. I'm as hot as they are. But we're going to talk about a hot topic on this week's podcast, episode 226. And we're going to talk about a very interesting story, maybe a story like no other, about a band from the late 80s, early 90s who feature two British men, a Scotsman called Bill Drummond and an Englishman, Jimmy Cauty, who created a notorious music project that topped the charts, aggravated the art world, upset the capitalists, annoyed the record industry and almost everyone else in its wake. That is, of course, the KLF, a.k.a. the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo, a.k.a. the Jams, a.k.a. the Time Lords. Other musicians have been known as provocateurs before, but the KLF were on a whole other level because they became a massive chart success while posing questions about the validity of art, original ideas, creativity, commerce and capitalism. This is a story of a band who did things like no one else, who had number one hits, who created art installations, defaced billboards, made cryptic advertisements, gave manic performances on Top of the Pops, fired machine gun blanks into the audience, became known as pranksters, and blew all their money in one notorious stunt. KLF is gonna rock ya. That is 3 a.m. Eternal from the KLF. Now, I guess the interesting thing about KLF in terms of their story is that the music is only really a part of it. It enabled them a lot to do what they wanted to do. Now, I ended up picking this episode a topic because I ended up watching the Who Killed the KLF documentary from 2021, which Andrea has now seen as well. We're going to be using that as our kind of a frame and a guide in which to explore this really interesting story. And it's a story that poses more than, it's like, what happens when two people who kind of are outsiders and who are thinking outside the box get put inside the industry box and have to figure out what it is they want and what they want to say with their art. And especially in the early 80s, late 80s, early 90s, there was a lot of people who were not happy that two men who made a lot of money were making questionable decisions with it. And also, I think it's really interesting. We've got a week of a lot to discuss, I think, on the KLF. Let's start up with the start. Bill Drummond is a Scotsman who was a manager for Echo and the Bunnymen and acts like the Teardrop Explodes. He played guitar in a Liverpool band, big in Japan as well. He became an A&R person. But when he always had this kind of abstract thinking into the way he approached things. In the documentary, it talks about how when he set up a tour of the Orkney Islands for Echo and the Bunnymen, his way of routing that show, the tour dates, was to draw a set of bunny ears across the Orkney Islands, and that's how the route that they took, the band took. So he was a critic of himself and a critic of the bands he worked with. He left the music industry in 1986. After managing those bands for quite a while. In the documentary, he says he made a lot of questionable decisions. And that's probably something which quite continues throughout his career. In 1987, him and Jimmy Cotty formed a band and wanted to make a hip-hop record. Well, Cotty had previously been in a terrible pop band called Brilliant, who Drummond had actually signed as an A&R person. And Cotty was an illustrator of J.R.R. Tolkien posters, one of which was the best-selling poster in the world for 8 years. Just one of the random facts that comes in around the KLF.
And one of the facts when I was watching the documentary that I was like, I don't know if that's true.
Yeah. But actually, I remember that. I remember that poster.
I know the poster.
Yeah.
I have a question mark about who designed it.
It was certainly used.
Yeah.
In the documentary at the start, Bill Drummond says, "We never set out at all to be this global, international, multi-successful dance pop crossover, whatever it was. It was never part of the game plan."
We should say up front that this documentary is not made by the KLF and was made without their blessing and permission, according to the Wikipedia page. Again, question marks over that. But when we say that Jimmy and Bill are talking, these are tapes that have been unearthed, sort of thing. So might be a self-mythologizing thing. It might be genuinely that they've absolutely nothing to do with it. But as we understand it, they've nothing to do with the documentary.
They are pretty happy, I think, as people, to let people speculate. And also, I mean, the truth of what they do a lot of the time is in question. And that is part of their story as well. And it's like, is it a myth? Is it real? Well, we'll get to it. On New Year's Day, 1987, Bill Drummond was at home with his parents after leaving the music industry. And he was going for a walk, and it was a bright blue sky. And he thought, I really want to make a hip hop record. And so to do this, he thought, how can I make a hip hop record? Who can I make a hip hop record with? He wasn't brave enough to do it himself. So he thought, although I can play guitar, I can knock out a few things on the piano. I knew nothing personally about the technology, and I thought I knew Jimmy. I knew he was like a spirit like me. We share similar tastes and backgrounds in music and things. So I phoned him up that day and said, let's form a band called the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo. And he knew exactly what I meant, to kind of phrase where I was coming from. Within a week, we had recorded our first single. So the music they had made in those early years clearly took inspiration from hip hop and the art of sampling, and would later develop into this bombastic form of stadium house music and trance music with big chords and pop melodies that just was big everything. It had a lot of big noise in it. It had a lot of crowd noise. It was, if it was designed, that's where the stadium stuff comes from. But in the early days, and the very first album that they released was 1987, called What the Fuck Is Going On. This is where their desire to do things that kind of upset people started. It is an 11-track album, and it features a lot of samples. It features like the likes of MC5. There's unlisted samples of television programs, including Top of the Pops. There is ambient noise from a London Underground station, The Monkees. Here is a track, a bit of a track called Don't Take Five, Take What You Want. I try to ignore, but his gaze held my eyes when he told me the truth about the past and the lies. Don't take five, take what you want to say. Don't take five, take what you want to say. Don't take five, take what you want to say. Don't take five, take what you want. So I told him some more about me and Rob, how we formed a band just around the block, how we searched for years for this African grind. I'd be lost with the diamonds down Solomon's mine. From the way he was dressed with his shield and spears, he was obviously a man with very few fears. So I asked him to join us in the quest for our grail. Leave a fight back behind with the unopened mail. So that is Don't Take Five, Take What You Want from the album What The Fuck Is Going On. It's not the most notorious one song on that record, because the one that was the most prominent was actually a song called The Queen and I. Now, in the early days, they were, Coty and Drummond were fully aware of, you know, copyright law and all that kind of stuff. But despite that, they made a song called The Queen and I, a derogatory political rap about the state of democracy in the UK, which samples the entire chorus of one of the most recognizable songs known to man, ABBA's Dancing Queen, and pairs it with some baby noises. Here is a bit of that. When I was younger, I knew just who to hate. From the teachers in our classroom to the leaders of our state. I'm registered to vote. This pleasant land's free. So I took the intercity for democracy and me. I knocked at the door, but they didn't let me in. So I kicked it down and I walked right in. She was standing at the bar while Healy cut his crust. Question time. Mikey Burke! Yeah, that's annoying. And that was the song that allowed them to start off their career of notoriety in many ways, because Bill Drummond says, being a manager, I obviously knew the copyright laws that went, that happened around making studio music. He said the ABBA were not happy with this record. They were certainly not fans of it. They didn't like the way it was handled. And the MCPS, that is the Mechanical Copyright Protection Society, got in touch with them and ordered all the masters and all copies destroyed because it was illegal and they didn't have permission, and all copies in the shop recalled. So in an attempt to avoid a court case, the two men decided to comply with this. But first they would try to meet ABBA and convince them that it was okay, that they could do this, that was creatively okay. So their idea was they would go to Sweden, and they took an NME journalist and a photographer along with them, because they were an industrious sort of folk who were always keen, had a keen eye with publicity. This is essentially a publicity stunt. So Jimmy Cauty had a Galaxy V8 Ford police car that was used a lot in their music videos and stuff. Very iconic kind of look to it. And that's apparently how they got there. Took a ferry then as well. They said, Bill Drummond says, if we made the stance of actually going to Sweden to meet them, it would have looked good for us in court and wouldn't have cost us as much. It made very sound financial advice to go there. Of course, things didn't go as planned. The Justified Ancients of Moomoo and their guests took the ferry to Sweden, drove cross-country to Stockholm, where they presented a gold disc in recognition of sales in excess of zero, not to ABBA, but to a blonde sex worker outside ABBA's studio at 3 a.m., the only person they could find who looked even remotely like one of the members of ABBA. Having done this, they stopped in a Swedish field on the way back to build a fire out of the burn all of the unsold copies, something that which will come back later on in terms of burning stuff. As they returned to the car to drive off, an irate Swedish farmer apparently appeared and started, who was not happy with the acrid black smoke coming out of his field, who apparently fired a shotgun at the car as it drove off, which promptly needed some repair. But yeah, so I think on the ferry home, they played their only live date ever before that as the Justified Ancients Moomoo for a Toblerone bar, and chuck some of the copies of the LP into the sea. So this is kind of the start of the pranks and the myths and the myth making that KLF did. There was also a thing they did with the Face magazine. It's like, so as a postscript to all this LP destruction, the KLF took out a full page ad in the Face magazine offering to sell 5 remaining unplayed copies for £1,000 each. They said, we were browsing around this record shop near our studios and came across 5 copies of the song or of the album. Now that we know that since the MCPS affair last year, they've been selling for between 30 and 75 pounds, we bought all 5. The advert in the Face because we thought its readers would be familiar with our work and aware of our existence. They might also be rash enough to pay that much, but I don't think Sounds readers would. It was a calculated gamble. Advert itself cost about £1,300. So if no one bought them, they'd be seriously out of pocket. But fortunately, they sold 2 and had offers on the 3rd. We found this loophole in this agreement. Although we were ordered to destroy all the remaining copies, we made it perfectly clear to the MCPS that we couldn't actually force the shops to send their LP back. Some actually did, and they were destroyed. So because we bought them in a shop, those LPs don't come into the agreement, and we can do what we like with them and not break any laws. So there was a big part of this story, certainly, is just like rubbing up against what's acceptable by society, what the laws that are established around us. And I think that's a lot of what they do. And I think the next biggest thing they did after that was, they got a number one hit. They got a number one hit with a big novelty record.
The only thing I knew that they had done before going into this.
Right.
I'd never heard of anything to do with the KLF, nothing at all. And when Harry was describing them to me, he was like naming their songs and like, oh, do you not know about the burning thing and blah, blah. I was like, no. And they were like, do you know the Time Lords? And I was like, yeah. He was like, that's them.
Okay, well, let's play a bit of this song. There's a massive story about this, and I think it comes with essentially what is called the manual. They followed a number of rules on how to make a hit number one record. They were inspired by Stock Aitken and Waterman, who are a hit factory machine in mid to late 80s, who were responsible for like producing records from Kylie, Bananarama, Mel and Kim, Dead or Alive, You Spin Me Round Like a Record, that's one of theirs, Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley, and one of theirs as well. They were quite influential in the UK, and they were essentially a hit factory. Everything they touched turned to gold. What they did, they took underground club hits and kind of Italo disco melodies, really, and turned them into more accessible club or like pop hits. So these were pop hits that were inspired by high energy disco music, Motown lyrics, Italo disco melodies. There's a really interesting episode, I think, in that as well, talking about that period of that, how they cornered that market and just made massive money out of from 1984 to 1989. Even Two Unlimited as well was one of their hits. So they took inspiration, the Time Lords, aka Jimmy Cauty and Bill Drummond, took inspiration from, and but they took it further. They, in 1988, they released a song called Doctor in the TARDIS by the Time Lords that went to number one. It was a complete novelty hit featuring 3 kind of main elements. It's a mashup of the Doctor Who theme music, the Gary Glitter rock and roll beat, and sections from a song called Blockbuster by The Sweet. For here they are as they get on to Top of the Pops and hit number one. Here is the audio from that.
And we have a brand new number one on Top of the Pops this week. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? There's a car. Hear the Time Lords.
So that is the Time Lords, the KLF Doctrine, the TARDIS is the name of the track, as you can hear there. It's got the Gary Glitter beat, it's got glam written all over it, it's got the Doctor Who theme music, it's silly, it's a novelty record, but it worked really well. And the other thing that these guys were really good at was presenting themselves. They presented themselves in a really interesting way. They're dressed up kind of as weird doctors or glam rock musicians, and they were very good at like building stages around them from their entire career. Their music videos are actually insanely good because they are the kind of people who spent the money that they earned on their music videos, and you can see it. There's a record that they released called What Time Is Love, and oh my god, the video for that is insane. It's shot on this like in Pinewood Studios or something. It's on a boat. There's all these people hanging off this like kind of a Viking boat kind of thing. It's insane. So it really is worth seeing that. Here is a bit of that song that was released shortly afterwards, a song called What Time Is Love. Yo, for the words I speak, rap is weak, so I teach and I reach a positive vibe, a way of life is how I'm living. So get hyped to the river. KLF is the crew, you hear, yeah. Design a bomb, I just won't fear. Back to react, enough is enough. Let me ask you a question. What time is love? What time is love? What time is love? What time is love? So after this, the what happened with the Time Lords was, I mean, that was very clearly a once-off novelty hit, and they would go on to release music as the KLF. But before we get there, in 1988, one of the most interesting parts of the story for me is The Manual. So The Manual was a little booklet that they wrote called How to Have a Number One the Easy Way, which the following year after the song went to number one in the UK, number four in Ireland. We weren't quite as enamoured with it as the UK was.
Fair enough.
But following the release of Doctrine and TARDIS, they wrote this book. So The Manual claims to be a step-by-step guide to creating a number one hit without the necessity of any funds or talent. So what they do is say, there's video footage in the documentary as well, Who Killed the KLF, of the band, the two of them selling kind of like the idea of the book and saying, we'll give you your money back if you don't get a number one, that kind of stuff.
In 3 months, I think, was their promise.
In 3 months, yeah. And the entire, I read it again yesterday, the entire thing is kind of pitched like, here's day one. And then it takes you through the various steps in which get to that number one. And while there's loads of things in it that aren't relevant anymore, but there's still lots of things that are, the stuff that isn't relevant is like about studio and finances and hiring a programmer and an engineer and all this kind of stuff. Still things you can do, but some of the basic stuff is really interesting. So I'll
go
through
some of this stuff. Is it presented as a serious book? Like could you pick this book up by accident and take it seriously? Or
no, it's not. Once you open it and read it, you're like, these lads are having a laugh. But they're also very serious about it. But I think that's kind of the KLF in a nutshell as well.
Yes,
They're very serious about having a laugh or trying to do stuff or showing people that like it was so easy for them to have a number one that it was like, well, why don't we just tell everyone else how to do it?
Yeah.
Because we did it and it was really easy. So this is what they did. They offered a money back guarantee to anybody who would not score a number one hit single after meticulously following these steps. One of the steps included, you must be skint and on the dole. Anybody with a proper job or tied up with full-time education will not have the time to devote to see this through. Also, being on the dole gives you a clearer perspective on how much of society is run. If you are already a musician, stop playing your instrument. Even better, sell the junk. It will become clearer later on, but just take our word for it for the time being. Sitting around tinkering with a port studio or musical gear, either ancient or modern, just complicates and distracts you from the main objective. Even worse than being a musician is being a musician in a band. Real bands never get to number one, unless they are puppets. So if you're in a band, get out now. Quit. That said, it can be very helpful to have a partner, someone who you can bounce ideas off and vice versa. Any more than two of you and factions develop and you may as well be in politics. There's no place for the nostalgia of the four lads who shook the world or the last gang in town. It goes on to say then you need to go and study the charts of the day, basically the top of the pops on Sunday and the charts on Sunday on the radio, the hits, sure. And it talks about like stuff like financing and all that kind of stuff. But the key stuff is the golden rules of the songwriting, right? So firstly, these are the top line kind of stuff. Firstly, it has to have a dance groove that will run all the way through the record and that the current generation will find irresistible. Secondly, it must be no longer than 3 minutes and 30 seconds. Just under 3 minutes and 20 seconds is preferable. Thirdly, it must consist of an intro, a verse, a chorus, second verse, a second chorus, a breakdown section, back into a double end chorus, and outro. Fourthly, lyrics. You will need some, but not many. Going on to say, it is going to be a construction job fitting bits together. You will have to find the Frankenstein in you to make it work. Your magpie instincts must come to the fore. If you think this just sounds like a recipe for some horrific monster, be reassured by us. All music can only be the sum or total part of what has gone before. Every number one song ever written is only made up of bits from other songs. There is no lost chord, no changes untried, no extra notes to the scale or hidden beats to the bar. There is no point in searching for originality. In the past, most writers of songs spent months in their lonely rooms, strumming their guitars, or bands in rehearsals have ground their way through endless riffs before arriving at the song that takes them to the very top. Of course, most of them would be mortally upset to be told that all they were doing was leaving it to chance before they stumble across the tried and tested. They have to believe it is through this sojourn they arrive at the grail, the great and original song that the world will be unable to resist. So it said, if there's, it talks about going on to say, if you can, you can try and take a cover, but the problem with taking a cover is that, you know, you, it depends on what the song is and which part it is. You can disguise and modify it, but then you're giving up some of your royalties and stuff like that. So it says, the best thing to do is to borrow liberally, but not directly. It talks about BPM specifically. In this day and age, no song with a BPM over 135 will ever have a chance of getting to number one. This is in 1988 now. The vast majority of regular club goers will not be able to dance to it and still look cool. The vast majority of indie bands, however large their cult following is, who play what various music journalists often describe as perfect classic pop, will never see the inside of the top five. One, for one reason alone, they perform all their songs above the 135 BPM ceiling. Their love, traumas, and balls of confusion, of hate and bile, all rush by at some immeasurable blur of a BPM. Basically saying, appeal to the lowest common denominator and have a catchy chorus. The next thing you have to have is a chorus. The chorus is the bit in the song that you can't help but sing along with. It is the most important element in a hit single because it is the part that most people carry around with them in their head when there's no radio to be heard, no video on TV, and they are far from the dance floor. It's a part that nags you while daydreaming in the classroom or at work as you walk down the street to sign on. It's the part that finally convinces the punters to make that trip down to the record shop and buy it. So slip on the 12-inch of your dance compilation and sing along with the breakdown sections. Any old words will do. Just whatever comes out of your mouth. You have difficulty forming a tune in your head, you feel a bit inhibited, flick through a copy of the Guinness Book of Hits or pick any top five record that takes your fancy and see if you can sing along the chorus with the track. Doctor Who, hey Doctor Who, Doctor Who in the TARDIS, Doctor Who, hey Doctor Who, Doctor Who, Doc, Doctor Who, Doctor Who, Doc, Doctor Who. Gibberish, of course, but every lad in the country under a certain age related instinctively to what it was about. The one slightly older needed a couple of pints inside him to clear away the mind debris left by the passing years before it made sense. As for girls in our chorus, we think they must have seen it as pure crap, a fact that must have limited to zero our chances of staying at Top of the Pops for more than 1 week. So that's part of what they talk about. It is really worth a entire read. It does kind of give up at the end because that's what the KLF were like. We're like, oh, we did it all now. And here's the book. But there were some acts that actually did follow their entire brief here and actually did it. The first one was a European, an Austrian dance band called Edelweiss. Now, this, I'm going to play a bit of the song, but
I love this.
Let's just say that this is bad. This is a bad song.
It's but truly it's a terrible record, so. But I love it.
Yeah.
You get the idea. You get the idea what was happening there. They were following the rules as directly as they could with the original kind of the ABBA thing and bringing together a very novelty thing of yodeling and a current pop hit, a big known, well-known pop hit. So SOS from ABBA there, which reached number one in 5 different countries, including New Zealand, and went on to sell 5 million copies worldwide. Now, obviously, things are very different now. I don't think a record like that would do well, but this was at the time. But I think there's still some rules to be learned, some things we can learn from the manual that apply to modern days. I remember the most recent example of someone I heard who had followed the manual was the band The Klaxons. And one of the bands said, I think it's Jamie Reynolds, "I literally read that book and put it into practice. I took direct instruction from it. Get yourself a studio, get a groove going, sing some absolute nonsense over the top, put a breakbeat behind it, and you're away. That's what I did. That's genuinely it. I read it. I noted down the golden rules of pop and applied that to everything we did and what we're doing and made sure that we always applies. That way we always come out with a sort of catchy hit number. You wonder why more people don't do it. This is it. It depends whether or not you want to be a pop band. We said we wanted to be a subversive pop band, and for our structure, I'm following the goals and rules of the KLF's manual every step of the way." So yeah. I think it's just that is really an interesting thing, and I think it's still some of that, while some of it doesn't apply obviously, but some of it does still, I think. If you're looking to make a number one, there's things you have to do.
What was the last common denominator big novelty song, would you say?
God, that's a good question. We haven't had a novelty song for
really
a while.
We haven't had one in a while, haven't we? Not,
they've kind of gone away. Does Dance With Me by Tones and I work? Dance Monkey, does that? No, that's not.
Yeah, maybe
a true novelty record.
I think Dance Monkey, relatively novelty, is it? Or is it just that we have literally no artistic, like, we don't consider it to be art at all? Maybe.
Probably, maybe like the trend of the sea shanty stuff.
When people started releasing that.
Kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And then it became... Yeah, I mean, it's hard. Like, if you look at the charts right now, like, is there anything in there that would be considered, like, even a Bob the Builder or something like that? You know, like, something
a
children's song.
We Baby Shark, but I think that was literally for children. I don't think that was ever supposed to be a chart thing.
That was just so catchy that it continued.
Great song.
To breakthrough. I mean, it's Kylie's Padam Padam kind of a novelty song. Like,
it follows
probably some of those golden rules, but like it's incessantly annoying in lots of ways, but
if Padam Padam was written about Aperol Spritz, it would be an opt. Do you know what I mean? Like, there needs to be a kind of a commercial tie-in somehow, or like a reference to another part of pop culture that's maybe a little bit kitsch.
Yeah. Well, look, like, I mean, Eiffel 65's Blue was a kind of a novelty hit of its day. And now, last year, David Guetta and Babe Rexha turned it into
a worst thing in the world.
Pop hit. Yeah. So that's where we're at now these days. It's hard to predict. But listen, back to the KLF. What they did after that was they changed their name to the KLF. And people would ask them what it meant, and they always give different answers. But really, they actually became a massive band. In the intervening years, they released 2 albums, Chill Out in 1990, which I could talk about later on, and The White Room in 1991, and a string of 5 top 5 singles, and they became the biggest selling act in the world in 1991. So here is Last Train to Transcentral from The White Room. Yeah, Last Train to Transcentral, just one of their big hits that they had. They also did things like collaborated with Tammy Wynette on the song Justified and Ancient. And a very strange record. Here we go.
They're justified and ancient. And they lie to
They wrote like catchy stadium house music, essentially. Like that's what it was. Trancy house music that had big pop melodies. Everything was big and bombastic, and it really worked at that time. It was the music that like people responded to. So 1991, that's around that time. For the summer solstice in 1991, the KLF entertained a selection of music industry figures, journalists off the Isle of Jura, off the coast of Scotland, in an event known as the Rites of Mu. Now, the Isle of Jura is a place that we will revisit an event, but on this one, they basically invited all these press journalists away for the weekend. And upon arrival, the guests were welcomed by Bill Drummond in full character mode, decked out in military garb, acting as a passport control officer, checking everyone's passport and stamping them with a pyramid blaster stamp. That evening, yellow robes were handed out to the press journalists and they were told to wear them, and they were marched down a muddy road to a beach where a film crew was waiting. And Bill Drummond, now wearing a white hooded robe and a fake rhino's horn protruding from his forehead, led the group in chants, like low kind of chants. And then there was a 40-foot wicker man that had been erected at the water's edge right at the summer solstice at 10:21. The wicker man was torched with the cameras recording everything. And the four angels of Mu, which were four people in white dresses with flower headbands, walked into the sea and joined the celebrants. The high priest addresses the crowd, this is Bill Drummond, in a tongue that no longer exists, at least not in this world. As the ceremony reaches its climax at midnight, the longest day, the priest encourages the guests to direct their psychic energy towards the wicker man, chanting, "Burn, burn, burn," and it bursts into flames. By sacrificing the wicker idol, somehow the KLF had reversed the fall of mankind, this is what they were saying. So not much happened the rest of the weekend, other than they had a massive party. Everyone in the documentary, there was a tin of ecstasy being passed around.
A Quality Street tin.
Quality Street tin of ecstasy. So they had a rave on the beach and had an arena-sized sound system, strobe lights and everything, blazing till dawn. So instead, the other thing that they did was instead of granting interviews, they turned the tables and had journalists on stage giving a concert. And so they could have the opportunity to see what it feels like from the other side. Now, the resulting, you can actually watch the, there's a 30-minute short film available online, and it's narrated by none other than Martin Sheen, which is just bizarre. It's called The Rites of Mu. It's from 1991.
That's the campus thing they've ever done, is get Martin Sheen to narrate that.
Yeah. I was watching it there yesterday and I was like, this is mad.
I can see him being into them. Yeah.
That was one thing they weren't great at. They weren't great. They were really interested in film, but they were never great at it. Creating, they thought they would make this film documentary called The White Room. And they traveled around America and brought cameras with them. But like, and they hadn't spent loads of money on it, but they didn't have a story. So it just became this weird collection of kind of interesting imagery more than anything else.
Or shots of them driving around.
Yeah, them driving around in the famous Ford car as well. So after this time, they had become this notorious multi-selling band, biggest pop singles band of the year. So we come to the Brit Awards. So
KLF in 1991.
Yeah, they were invited in 1991 to perform. They suggested in 1991 that their suggestions included sacrificing live elephants and stuff on stage, that the invitation was cancelled. Then the following year, they were approached to do it again because they were up for an award. I think it was Best New Artist. Best New Band at the Brits. So somehow they persuaded the organisers to let them perform with a band called Extreme Noise Terror, who are basically a heavy metal band. A trash metal band. And so they performed a version of 3 AM Eternal on stage that night. But before that, they had all these dastardly plans that they wanted to do. Following on from the sacrificing live animals, they decided they would cut up a dead sheep or kill a dead sheep live on stage in front of the audience and throw its blood all over the front rows.
Which they didn't do.
They didn't do, but Bill Drummond says the original idea was that 2/3 of the way through the song, this altar would appear with the sheep on. and it would come on, and we'd bought the meat cleavers, the knives, the tablecloth, got everything. But on the morning of the show, he actually did drive to an abattoir in Northampton and bought a whole dead sheep and 8 gallons of blood. But the band that they were playing with, the Extreme Noise Terror, were actually vegetarians, hardcore vegetarians at the time. And they said, we're not doing this if you do that. BBC lawyers were obviously not very happy about this either. So Briss was on the BBC then. So instead, they settled on performing 3AM Eternal in this thrash metal noise way. And then Bill Drummond fired blanks from a machine gun over the audience's heads. So here's a bit of how that sounds.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, so if you hear, listen closely there, you can kind of hear the KLF or Bill Drummond firing blanks from a machine gun over the heads of the audience. Why did they do this? I mean, this is what they were like. They didn't do things the easy way. They didn't want to be courted by the music industry. The good thing about what the KLF did, as the documentary makes clear, is that they were in charge of their own masters and they were in charge of their own production. They didn't sign to a label. They released all these things themselves. They licensed music but all of the records and stuff that they bought and processed and gotten done on a record plant went to their studio. And I think that is one of the reasons why then when the same Brit Awards, they were awarded the best British band jointly with
Simply Red.
Simply Red. Yeah, I mean, what an insult to a band like that.
Really. Can you see in my notes?
I can't see it now. What does it say?
It says Simply deep. Red, lol, in like all caps. I was taking these while I was watching it. I laughed the most at that part. I think it's Bill says to someone at some point in the documentary, he's like, yeah, the British music industry were letting us know that we were as good as Simply Red. And
exactly.
And I love that so much.
The height of their creative career, you know.
Yeah. But what I loved about that section as well is it showed a clip of the beginning of the Brit Awards, which at this time began with an announcer saying, ladies and gentlemen, the British music industry presents the Brit Awards. So it is the British music industry. It's the perfect place for them to literally like take up arms and fire at it. It makes complete sense for them to have done that. And I think that performance is like, it's genuinely one of my favorite things I've ever seen. Like, I love the Brit Awards. I love the chaos of the Brit Awards, but like the fact that I'd never seen it before, I was like, I was so giddy watching it. I thought it was incredible. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, and it's genuine. Like, apparently the reaction in the audience was one of, like, there was people that were, like, trying to leave the audience because they thought that, like, he has a machine gun in his hand and he's kind of stalking the stage. And he looks quite menacing, and he is an imposing figure, and then he starts firing these blanks into the audience, and you know, I'm sure that was a bit, there were people like, what the fuck?
Yeah, but then as you can hear in the clip, the kind of very polite British applause at the end when they finish and they go off stage and the curtain comes down. It's very, very funny.
And I think there's an element of this band, and we'll get to it a little bit later on, because I have some reaction to something that they did in this country as well, and I think people just were like, didn't have time for them, and they didn't really have time for the industry either. So when they won this award with jointly with Simply Red, Simply Red at that time was basically taking old R&B songs and making them his own, and not telling, I think at the time probably people thought he was like writing those songs a little bit as well. There was some elements of maybe, like, you know, you're using black musicians' music from the past and pass them off as your own, as this like northern English white guy.
Yeah.
So that
and
was,
you're
yeah,
also
that was
so a... annoying. Just like I have such annoying. A visceral reaction to Simply Red songs. Like, I really,
I like some
really
of them.
Hate...
I do. I really
oh,
do.
God,
but,
no.
Not some of them. Yeah. I mean, I think he does some. Like, they're cheesy, but I like some of them.
I always
well.
Hate him because he was really big when I was a kid. Like, he'd be on the radio a lot when I was a kid, and on like the music stations when I was a kid. And even
maybe
then,
that's how you know you've grown up. You're like, Simply Red. Actually,
no,
Banks.
No. Consider me a child forever then. No, I'll always hate that man. I don't know what it is.
Okay, so when they won that award with Simply Red, they had already left. So they sent their pal, who was dressed in motorcycle messenger gear, up to pick it up. And they wouldn't actually let him in. So he just ran on stage and grabbed it. And then there was a bit of confusion. And then he was actually tackled to the ground as well. But at the after party, the band actually did leave the carcass of a dead sheep outside the after party venue with a sign that said, "I died for you. Bon appetit." And
EWE.
Then they buried their Brit Award. I died for you. Mm-hmm. They buried their Brit Award statuette in a field near Stonehenge, which was later recovered. And then apparently they went back again and
buried it again. Question mark over that. Because one of them says in the documentary, oh, there's a big archaeological dig there. And we were hoping it would show up, but it didn't. I've my doubts as to whether or not they went back and buried it again. Yeah. But but it's very funny. You know, they've such a sense of like of aesthetics, like the idea of them going to Stonehenge, and like it really ties in with that music industry, that music journalist sort of party that they had that was very pagan, and like they'd such a strange sense of aesthetics, and I just love them, the idea of them going up to Stonehenge and sneaking past the guards, which they had to do, and they had to be really quiet, and they dug like this like quite small hole to bury it, and yeah, it's so funny.
But the end of that Brit's performance, there's an announcement over the system that you can't quite hear on that recording there, but it says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the KLF have now left the music business." Mm-hmm. And that was officially the end of their career, really, because that same year, very suddenly and very publicly, they retired and they deleted their entire back catalogue. What that meant is they no longer sold it. And obviously, this is a time when it was only physical copies of music that were available, and they stopped selling it. And that is covered in the documentary a little bit. One of their I don't know what he is exactly. Is he their like label manager or accountant or something like that? And he's just like
the wizard guy.
Yeah. Oh, no, not John Moore. No, but there's a guy that's like, he's clearly involved. But
that's
what they decided to do. I mean, what could we say? But there's parts of it there. They talk about how things were getting out of hand. Drummond had been like conceiving new ways of like maybe not shocking people, but like of making statements, and one of them was like included cutting his own hand off. And he was like, I think they got to the point where they were starting to make these like trying to hang a cow carcass up on a pylon and they were like, why are we doing this? Nobody cares.
The hand thing, so, I think, was an idea they wanted to do with the Brits. He wanted to chop his hand off and throw it into the audience of the Brits.
Yeah, here, have us, literally.
There was there was a connection made with the Red Hand of Ulster in the documentary that I don't think quite landed for me.
That feels tenuous to me.
It did feel a bit tenuous to me. I think it was more of a like a nihilistic Discordianism thing, which we'll probably talk a bit more about later in terms of their philosophy. Yeah. But like, I think it was much more to do with that than making any kind of like political statement.
Yeah. Well, their music was officially deleted at that point in 1992 and wasn't available again officially until 2013 when it appeared back on iTunes. Before that, there's loads of other things that happened. They became the K Foundation. The K Foundation was the next thing that it did. Officially, they split as the KLF, but they continued working together under the name the K Foundation. And they released one limited edition single called K Sara Sara and awarded a 40,000 Foundation Art Award for the worst artist of the year to the artist Rachel Whiteread's. So that year, the Turner Prize was awarded to an artist called Rachel Whiteread. And in contrast to this, the KLF awarded her 40,000 pounds for the K Foundation Award for the worst artist of the year. And one of the things about this was that, you know, they were trying to make points about, art and money and how it's valued and how people are perceived. So what they actually did was they nailed £1 million in 50 quid notes to a large frame board. This is our artwork called Nailed to the Wall. And what they did was they said if she didn't turn up and accept
They chained it to the gates of the Turner Institute. So they chained it to the gates and they gave Rachel a time limit and said, if you don't come and claim your prize, then we'll burn it. And she didn't want to accept this prize. She just won the Turner. I think she was the first woman ever to win the Turner. And she didn't want to do it, but there's obviously she said there's a clip of her in the documentary where she says that she felt blackmailed into coming and collecting it because it would be burnt otherwise. So she came and collected it after the deadline, but they kept it there for her. She came and collected it and then immediately gave it away afterwards. It's not clear who she gave it away to.
She would give it as grants to needy artists. So I don't know.
And I think I think that's what she did. She didn't want it for herself because it's not a prize. It's her being used as part of someone else's art installation. So she gave it away anyway. But there was a few people in the documentary saying like, I wish they'd burnt it, which will come up later. But maybe we'll get onto that now. But I think that sense of aesthetics, like I feel like once they became the K Foundation, for me, like I'm really interested in them as musical artists, but once they became the K Foundation, I feel like they really became artists and provocateurs. And once they started doing things like if you take the book, for example, it's like, oh, here's the recipe for a number one, right? They understood and they knew exactly what it was that they were doing at all times. And it's at this point in their careers together that they step out of what they understand and they lean more into like whatever their artistic urges are. And those urges are to kind of like create chaos. I don't know if they consider themselves to be that like political. I don't think themselves, when they're sitting around talking about their art, consider themselves to be overtly political or, you know, provocateurs or anything like that. But, you know, they obviously are. Maybe will we talk about the million quid?
Yeah, I mean, like we said, burning things has been something that is a theme in the KLF's journey so far. And of course, the biggest one and the thing that they are most notorious for is the K Foundation burned a million quid. That was when, on 23rd of August 1994, in a boathouse in the Scottish island of Jura, Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty incinerated £1,000 in cash. That's what they did. They set fire to £1 million in cash on it, and they filmed it. They brought their friend Gimpo, who was their kind of videographer, and a guy called Jim
Reed. A freelance journalist as well, I think.
Freelance journalist Jim Reed, to an abandoned boathouse in Jura on 23rd of August 1994 and burnt it. Now, they then made a film out of this, but I think the big thing, I mean, this was such a, like, I remember this so vividly from when I heard about it, because it was like, wow, they're the, and because that's all that the KLF became after this. They became a band who had burnt £1 million, and that was the whole story. And Jim Reed wrote an article for GQ called Money to Burn. He says he admits to feeling guilty at first, then boredom while watching the money burn. Drummond and Cotty then took the resulting film that they made and started showing it around the UK, like, and to various different reactions, and like, people were angry with them, didn't believe that they'd done it, thought it was fake money, but the big question really became why they did it, and they never had a good answer for it, and I think they don't really know why they did it themselves. I mean, there has been suggestions that, if you look into it, that, like, yeah, they clearly had more money than this single £1 million, that, yeah, they did burn it. That doesn't seem to be in dispute, but they certainly had other money in the in a bank account somewhere that they have profited off. And so it became this, like, massively divisive thing that they did. Why did these two men who made loads of money from pop music take the money and burn it for £1 million?
What I think is so interesting about the film they made is, like, to be clear, the film is just the money burning. It lasts around an hour, and it's just the money burning. It's not narrated. It's not even shot with them, like, walking up to the house, deciding to do it, like, you know, feeling strange about it, talking about it, narrating it. It's just an hour of them burning £1 million. And, you know, as you said, they toured around the UK and they showed it in Ireland as well, as we'll talk about it in a minute. But I found the reactions to that so interesting. I'm really curious as to how you feel about it, because for me, I felt a really initial sort of visceral, like, reaction to it, where I just had this image of, like, if I was there, just, like, shoving my hand into the embers and trying to save some of that money. And I think I think this is the single greatest artistic endeavor that they've embarked upon. Like, the reaction to it was absolutely astounding. There were some people who felt the way I do, that it was art, and that it made a very real point about, like, what is £1 million, and who decides what you get to do with it, and, you know, like, if why don't we have a problem when people waste £1 million, like, because the big question is why didn't you give it to charity, right? And the answer to that is there's plenty of £1 million in the world that aren't being given to charity. They're being spent on boats and, you know, on art, art pieces and cars and drugs.
Keeping and hoarding money and all that kind of stuff.
No, like, there's £1 million that's just gone up people's noses, and nobody cares about that. You know, people spend on drugs and boats and whatever it is, and nobody seems to have a problem with that, and how that is, you know, it's the same thing as burning it, you know, and I think that they were, they the round number of £1 million, which at the time, it is still now an awful lot of money, but at the time it was an awful lot more money than it is now. It's a nice round number. It's incredibly provocative. And it doesn't evoke the same feeling in everybody. And I think that art is kind of supposed to do that. So I went through, like, a range of emotions while watching that. And I just can't remember the last time I saw some kind of art that wasn't music that kind of made me feel that way. I think it's incredible, but what's your thought on it? Because you were aware of it, like, long before I was.
Yeah, so. Well, I think when I first heard of it, it was something I was like, it was more the incredulity of it. It's like, I can't believe these people have done this, and they couldn't have done it. And as time gone on and revisiting now, I'm like, okay, they really must have done it. But I think I really like the gray area that exists from them when they're talking about it. Famously, they appeared on The Late Late with Gay Byrne, and they discuss a lot of those topics. And like, people are like, why didn't you give it to charity?
Yeah.
Why didn't you do it this? Your man from Joe from Def Leppard is on as well.
And he said,
you set up a studio for kids and all this kind of
for
stuff.
For unemployed and kids, he said. And I was like, what? Who are these unemployed kids who you're trying to get in the studio? Like,
yeah. But he, like, I think, and Bill Drummond says at one point, like, this is a construct. This is paper. This is like, it's like they're making a point about, you know, we know that like money is a social construct and now, and like, you know, like it's more obvious to think about music or think about money as this object that we have all created and bought into, and therefore to burn it, I think it's less visceral now because it feels like, well, this is physical money that was burnt. We know that people waste money all the time. We know people make million quid in a day sometimes. And I think the what they're trying to pose is way more interesting.
Yeah.
And it is long lasting because it's not something that has a simple answer.
Well, Bill Drummond makes a really interesting kind of counter argument that the Late Late audience are not interested in hearing, which is that burning a million quid doesn't mean, you know, on the charity argument, doesn't mean that there's any fewer loaves of bread in the world. And I think that that's a really, like, you know, even the idea of charity is a capitalistic construct, right? The idea that we will all help one another, that people within a state will donate to charity so that governments don't need to intervene and help out. And I think there was something about watching them on The Late Late. I don't know, are you going to play a clip?
Yeah, I mean, it is 21 minutes long, so I haven't picked out particular clips.
We'll play a little snippet, but I mean, first of all, I think Bill Drummond says one of the most profound things about it, and I think he probably should have even left it at this, which was, we knew we wanted the money, but we wanted to burn it more. And I think that that's an incredible statement. But the whole segment, and I actually think Gay Byrne does a really good job in this. He's clearly offended by this having happened, but he's really trying to get answers. And so the whole segment is them defending what they've done, right? And I think when you get two people who have done something like this and you put them in a situation where they can discuss it, it might yield really good results. But because this was all happening in the immediate aftermath, that Late Late audience is going to be made up of people who'll never see a million quid in their lives. A lot of them will be struggling financially, will have, you know, family members who need, you know, hip replacements and operations. That comes up a lot. Like, what if your children need an operation 10 years down the line, and so on. But getting two artists like this, who by their own admission, you know, don't know why they did it, to sit in a room and defend why they did it is relatively fruitless at the time. But looking back at it now, and I think socially things have kind of moved more towards a distrust and you know, a kind of questioning around what the value of money is. I think it's a really interesting text to look at, that Late Late interview. It's incredible.
I think we, as a modern society and people in a modern society now, have the language in which to interrogate that much more. I think that in if that interview was happening now, there'd be much more nuance. It wouldn't be just like, these men are ridiculous, or somebody rings in is like, I'm a psychiatrist and I know there's going to be loads of work for me looking at these lads kind of thing. And then people who are just like, just can't understand. There's people in the audience, in fairness, who are like, I think it's great. I think it's great that they did it.
Yeah.
I think it's an artistic statement. And then there's a fashion student from NCAD who's like, they're just looking for attention.
They're just looking for attention. Yeah.
And then
amazing about it is that, right, so there's people talking about the artistic value of the work, you know, whether or not it is an artistic statement. The two lads don't ever really, you know, confirm or deny that. But there's plenty of people in the world who spend a million quid on a music video or on a film that is, you know, propaganda for the military or something like it? It's like, it's fine to spend a million quid on materials with which to build art or with which to make art, but it's not okay to quote unquote spend that £1 million by burning it and creating an art piece that, to be honest, is more provocative, is more emotionally resonant than, you know, almost anything I've seen. Like, I think it's genuinely amazing. And for them to be the first ones to do it is obviously a very important thing. But like, why are we okay with them spending so much money on their music videos, for example? As you were saying earlier, they pulled all
their
money.
It's their money.
Why is
it's
that okay? And it's not okay for them to burn
it.
In
the
interview,
it's like, anything would have been better than this.
Yeah. And I find that so interesting. Why? Why is there a moral value assigned to buying things when there's no moral, or to giving money away to other people when there's no moral value assigned to deciding that what you want to do is get rid of this money and get rid of the hold that it has on you in your life? Like, I think it's this project, this art project, The Burning. I don't know if it actually has a name.
The K Foundation Burn £1 million, that's the film. So that's
sure,
kind of
yeah. I think
called,
that has more to say than, you know, almost any other anti-capitalistic art piece I've seen. I think it has a lot more to say than, like, I don't know, Banksy or something. Do you know what I mean? And it's because of the risk involved in it. And like, when I was watching the clips of them touring the film, and, you know, like, to remind people are coming in to watch an hour long film of £1 million being burnt, and they probably paid in as well. To me, that feels like a genuinely dangerous thing to do, is to sit in a room while you show people that you've done that. I think it's incredibly provocative and interesting, and I love it. I think it's the best thing they've done. It's amazing. I hope they never talk about it again.
I mean, I wonder if they will. Let's play a bit of some of the audio, and I'll dig out some of the best podcasts.
We made a lot because our records were hits all over the world, and we were in control of our own situation as well. So, but we wanted to stop when we stopped. I mean, there's a lot of reasons for wanting to stop, but at least we stopped before our records were useless records. Most people can only make good records for a short period of time.
Well, that's no particular reason to give up. I mean, if we all gave up just because we're not the best.
I understand you've been doing this for 33 years. And I'm thinking, how can you, you know, but obviously you're still the best at what you do. But in pop music, you know, you've been doing the show.
I've seen him come and go. Apart from Cliff, I suppose. Yeah. With the exception.
And we thought, you know, it's better to get out while you're ahead.
So you went and took this £1 million and you started burning it. You've been asked it a million times, I know. What about all the people who want hip replacement operations and old people and young people and handicapped people and kidney transplants?
Obviously, we thought about that, and we're not a charitable organisation. We thought that there's plenty of people who want to give money to charity. We wanted to do something that we found more interesting with the money. More interesting than giving it away to charity.
Us burning that money doesn't mean there's any less loaves of bread in the world, any less apples, any less anything. The only thing that's less is a pile of paper.
No, there could have been a little more. It's not less, but there could have been a little more.
More what?
Bread, more apples, whatever.
No. We didn't burn any loaves of bread.
No, but
we didn't burn any apples.
But you could have bought loaves of bread.
No, but those loaves of bread would still have existed. Do you know what I mean? There's actually nothing. There's nothing less in the world other than a pile of paper.
I used to talk to my dad like that when I was 16.
Well, I'm still talking to my dad like that, and I'm 42.
Did you and Rick know the music of Bill and Jim?
That's their blue shirt. Yeah, hi.
Yeah, I think it's disgusting that two people should be allowed to do such a thing with so much poor in this country and in the foreign countries. It's an absolute disgrace.
Their argument is it's their money. They can do what they like with it.
Yes, I can.
So, that's a bit of the interview on the Lele. Very well worth a watch. That was Joe Elliott, of course.
Yeah.
He's been throughout my life on TV, giving a serious side eye in that clip to Bill Drummond.
It's a clip, like, it is, what did you say, 20 odd minutes, but it is well worth watching. And just to say, there's people that are going to be listening to this who think that this is, who completely disagree with what they've done, don't think it's an artistic statement, think that they should have given the money to charity and so on. And I don't think either of us are saying we think it's right or wrong, but, you know, we just appreciate it. But, you know, that's it's important to recognize that there's a spectrum of responses to this, all of which are correct and valid. You know, if you're angry about it, that's, I completely understand why people are angry about it, because it was my first reaction to it as well. But
in terms of the late, late lore, it's up there with Frank McCourt and Gerry Hannon in 1999 for me. It's like, these are two amazing clips that are worth, that should be secured in a vault and never burnt in a digital vault, but just like they're such brilliant examples of our lives through TV and how we interact, and especially the, like, you can hear the jeers of people in the audience there who don't understand. And I think it's so interesting,
and it's so funny, because I was watching this clip and I was thinking about what it tells us about Ireland at the time, and I was wondering, if this happened today, would the reaction to it be any different? And I don't know that it would. I don't know. Like, I feel like we'd still be angry, right?
People would be talking to Joe about this, all right, for sure.
Yeah. And maybe if we didn't have Gay there to kind of provide a little bit of, like, I wouldn't say he's a moderate on this topic. Like, he's clearly against it having happened, but there's something in him that has, like, an appreciation of what they're trying to say. But the two lads, they struggle to explain it. They don't get a lot of cheers and claps for things that they say that I think are actually, like, very powerful. They get, like, the few people in the audience that support them will clap for them and so on. But they're not very good at defending it or explaining why they did it. But of course they don't have to be. Like, they don't. They shouldn't have to be, you know, they're artists. The statement is in itself what they want to say. Like, they did it because they wanted to say something about that, and that was their way of expressing it. And they're not great at expressing why. Although I do think the loaves of bread thing is very powerful. And of course, the we wanted the money, but we wanted to burn it more, I think is amazing.
Absolutely. I think it's still, and I think they say it in that piece as well, like, it's with us for our entire lives. It's never going to go away. Mm-hmm. And it is. And while they have gone away and come back a number of times in various ways, after the burning of £1 million, they worked again in 1997 with a campaign called Fuck the Millennium, which was a song by, officially they were called 2K, and essentially they did a 23-minute live performance satirizing the pop comeback, in which they appeared as grey-haired pensioners and wheeled around the stage in electric wheelchairs, and kind of just talking, like, kind of trying to represent, kind of satirize that kind of stuff. Here is an MTV news report from 1997, which makes clear a lot of what they've been up to after the burning of £1 million.
Strange things have been happening in London. In fact, one of the weirdest events in musical history occurred last Wednesday, when Jimmy Cauty and Bill Drummond, both former members of chart-topping band The KLF and famous for burning £1 million, formed a new group for 23 minutes and then split up. A clever criticism of today's bands? An ingenious artistic statement? Or just a load of old hype? MTV's Eddie Temple Morris went along to find out what on earth's been going on.
A brief history of Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty, alias KLF, the greatest rave band in the world ever. January 1987, they formed Justified Ancients of Moo Moo. They didn't rock, they raved. In 1988, they changed their name to the Time Lords, and their rave classic, Doctoring the TARDIS, topped the charts around Europe. 89 and through the early 90s, now operating as the KLF, that's the Copyright Liberation Front, they had a string of worldwide hits with 3 AM Eternal, What Time Is Love, and Justified and Ancient with country star Tammy Wynette. Then when they won Brit Award for Best Band in 92, they hijacked the ceremony with machine guns and threatened to cover the audience in sheep's blood before the audience heard this voice.
Ladies and gentlemen, the KLF have now left the music business.
So that's pop sorted, art next, and they formed the K Foundation, gave a £40,000 prize for the worst piece of art in the UK to the same woman who won the Turner Prize for the best piece of art at £20,000. She didn't want it, but the K Foundation said if she didn't take it, they'd burn the £40,000. Now comes the really mad bit. They took £1 million in cash they'd hoarded from their pop days, took it to a small island off Scotland, and burnt it. What next, you may ask? Well, with the year 2000 coming up, you could rely on these guys to do something different. Shrouded in secrecy since it was announced, this week they held a 23-minute performance under the name of 2K, the year 2000, if you will. They filled the Barbican Hall in London with fans and music business alike, all gagging to know what these two were going to pull off this time. In true KLF fashion, even their own spokesman didn't know what Drummond and Courty would do on the night, and this is minutes before they're due to go on stage.
The good part about working with Bill and Jimmy, whether they're calling the KLF, the K Foundation, or 2K, is that they never quite let us in on what's going on.
Familiar clues to the KLF roots included those famous head horns. Oh, and that 23-minute version of What Time Is Love. The performance included real lifeboatmen and the actual Liverpool dockers who've been fighting the British government since they lost their jobs years ago. With the 23 minutes up and the curtain about to fall, reaction in the crowd was good. Words like provocative and brilliant were bouncing around the hall, and another chapter in the history of the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo was closing. The very next morning, staff arriving at the Festival Theatre on the River Thames, one of the most famous landmarks in London, were horrified to see this painted in huge letters on their beloved structure. Less the KLF have left the building, more the KLF have left something on the building.
What the KLF had left on the building was a sign that said 1997, what the fuck is going on, 10 years on from their debut album.
Which you don't get news reports like that anymore. That's no, great stuff.
Eddie Temple Morris and MTV. There you go. That kind of gives you a brief history in what they were up to throughout their career. And then afterwards.
There was another art piece that they did where they, I can't remember what the exact amount was, but they glued or nailed, say, for example, like 25 grand to a board and they sold it for 12 grand. They sold it for half of what the money on the board was worth. And I think they made like two or three of those kind of little art pieces, which I also think is very funny.
That was nailed to the wall. The so they had a reserve price of half a million, but they put million on.
Oh, that was it. Yeah. It's brilliant. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was another thing they did. So, I mean, they've never really gone away. And one of the reasons why I chose this is because they came up like a couple of weeks ago. Mm. So there was a Resident Advisor article that said the British band KLF have recreated their album 1987, What the Fuck Is Going On, and donated the only copy to the British Library. The record can be streamed in the Library Sound Gallery until August 30th, obviously done now, after which you'll be able to hear in the British Library reading rooms. The original record was released in 1987 by the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo and included, obviously, the ABBA Dancing Queen. The recreated version is credited not to the KLF, but to the Ice Cream Van. That's Ice Cream with a K. And the British Library released a statement saying, in part, today the British Library announced it has acquired the acetate, a unique disc containing a reconstructed version of 1987, What the Fuck Is Going On, but a Justified Ancients of Moo Moo, later known as the KLF, and also find KLF communication master tapes. There followed this statement from the Ice Cream Van. As a lifetime card-carrying and founding member of the KLF Reenactment Society, I felt it was my duty to not only reenact the Justified Ancients of Moo Moo's album from 1987, but to present it in the world in a way far superior than the original version. That said, I'm very aware that even if they are not aware, that I am aware that my aging ice cream men have pirated a copy of my reenactment and have had that acetate cut of it and have donated their pirated copy to the British Museum for those that visit such places. Yours forever, the Ice Cream Van. And that was only like in August, so they have.
So is that still in the reading room now?
Yeah, it says it's there now.
Oh, cool! I'm going to be in London in December. Maybe I'll go see it.
Go and listen to it.
Yeah, I think I will.
They have appeared. I think 2017 was another one. Had a novel called A Trilogy. They had a 3-day festival, which is shown in the documentary Welcome to the Dark Ages. And they have also confirmed that their work is an ongoing project, and they've gone off and done individual stuff as well. In 2014, I actually spent an afternoon with Bill Drummond in Marsh's Library in Dublin, when he came over to do an event for Young Hearts Run Free. Shout out to Siobhan Kane for that, her cool series of events that happened. So she invited him over to give a performance lecture. Which was called How to Sell Your Soul to the Devil. To be honest, I think he just kind of very we all hung out in Marshall's library that day. You know, Marshall's library is a cool old library, and he just kind of talked to the audience about what he'd done. And I don't remember too much specifics about it, but just like being kind of like, wow, this is Bill Drummond, the man from the KLF.
That's so cool.
But the other thing I remember about him that day is that he was really into knitting. Knitting was his big thing. And so he took people on a knitting walk earlier that morning. And so there's pictures of him walking around Dublin with a group and they all have knitting things. It's really weird.
Oh, I wish I'd known them then. I could have gone knitting with him.
2014. So he remains an interesting person, and they remain compelling people to talk about, and they do appear every now and again and do things, and it is really interesting that that's why I was like, God, there they are again. August 2023, doing stuff with the British Library is like, they never go away. They're always around, and it's an ongoing project. And I mentioned then the Chill Out album, actually, and I wanted to give a special moments to that, because it was one of the first ambient albums that I ever heard. It was came out in 1990, an ambient style concept album featuring samples portraying a mythical nighttime journey throughout the US from the Gulf Coast states, beginning in Texas and ending in Louisiana. There's like sheep noises or sheep on the cover. It was conceived as this continuous piece of music with ambient music from the KLF. Some of the kind of some of their famous melodies are in there as well, but also has songs from Elvis Presley, Fleetwood Mac, Van Halen, 808 State.
It's really beautiful. It's a really beautiful singers. Record.
It is, you know, it is really, really, really
Harry
interesting.
Harry said he can't remember if he read it in a review or if somebody said it, but somebody described it as a music dreaming about itself. I thought was really a really beautiful way to describe it. And that's what it does sound like. It's very kind of, it's little snippets and very dreamlike and beautiful. Yeah, it's really nice.
For sure. It's really nice. Here's a bit of Baltimore to Fair Play from that album. So the KLF had regular collaborators and people that they were involved in, like the Orb, who did a lot of this kind of stuff. So I think this was one of those things where they did something that just sounded completely different to anything else they'd done. And it's one of their best records, 5th February 1990. Certainly going back and revisiting now, you hear a lot of very bombastic. They're trying to almost like keep it ambient, but they can't help but like bring some of that bombast in. But it for me, for an ambient album, that one of the first albums I heard, I remember my pal had it and gave it to me on, I think I borrowed a copy of it on a CD, and I have it still somewhere. But that is really, really, really lovely. All of this music and all of their albums pretty much appeared on Spotify for the first time in 2021 under slightly different names. That's on an album called Come Down Dawn, which is essentially the Chill Out album. And then Solid State Logic 1 and 2 are there as well. Also, some of their albums. So the White Room is there as well. And it always confused me, for anyone else who ever thought about this, and I never really was sure. Like, there's versions of 3AM Eternal and stuff like that that say like live at the SSL. The SSL is just a solid state Logic. It's just their studio. So it was never a live version at all. It was just like this weird thing that they did. It'll add end to all this is that the KLF were an influence on a very surprising band.
Surprising band. I don't know.
You can actually, there is some similarities in their bombast, for sure. Let's say a German techno band called
Kraftwerk?
Scooter.
Oh, okay. I was like, Kraftwerk? They're around before them.
yeah. So the singer H.P. Baxter of Scooter says, hearing the KLF for the first time was a decisive turning point in my life. I remember it like it was yesterday. A local radio station in Hanover played What Time Is Love on a Saturday in the summer of 1990, and my fate was changed forever. It was the track's second release, live a transcendental version with a rap by Isaac Bello, and also included crowd cheering, a siren sound, and a high-pitched chorus, and this amazingly hypnotic synth sequence that we later secretly used on dozens of Scooter tracks. What always fascinated me was how the KLF created their own megalomaniac world with a heavy, healthy dose of irony. It was all very ambiguous, anarchic, smart, and funny. They released studio recordings that sound like they've been recorded in a stadium, which they also marketed as such. I mean, Transcendental was their studio. Scooter's very own Hyper Hyper also later on included massive crowd cheering. And to this day, our liner notes always included surreal claims like made at Sheffield Underground Studios 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, as if everything was recorded in 8 different studios with superhuman amounts of gear and effort. In the past, I even wrote in London. It wasn't until years later that I actually read the manual How to Have a Number One the Easy Way by Drummond and Cauty. I was proud to realise that Scooter had followed most of the rules in the book without even knowing of its existence. I was especially amused by the parts about the singer having to be the greatest asshole imaginable. But that's another story. Well, around 2000, we read an interview where Bill Drummond was asked who he saw as our successors. When I read the name Scooter, I couldn't believe it. There was always been this suspicion amongst music and musicians and fans that KLF were true masterminds behind Scooter. When Ramp, the logical song, made it into the UK and Australian charts, our English label was approached by a number of people demanding that they admit that KLF were us. I couldn't imagine more flattering praise.
Oh, that's kind of adorable. That's really sweet.
So it kind of just shows that actually Scooter, while they look like they, I mean, the music is very dumb, but I think they are following a lot of what they do. Like, here is Hyper Hyper. I remember buying this on a cassette when it came out, and it is has a lot of the same stuff going on for it.
Hyper Hyper! Hyper Hyper!
Yeah, there you go. So,
what about
you can
Maniac
2000? Between...
Where does that fall in the lineage here?
Oh,
the crowd
yeah,
noises
I mean
and
that's
so
probably
and not on
the
Spotify,
rules,
so,
isn't it?
Yeah,
maybe too high of a BPM to truly qualify. But
maybe
I'll have to check that.
And
check
only a hit
BPM
in this country, as well,
2000.
So. Yeah. Huh? Only a hit in this country as well.
That's true, but that's okay. That's all right. That's our version of it.
That's our KLF, Mark McCabe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Maniac 2000 is apparently 148 beats per minute. Wow.
Wow.
Okay. I have to double check that one. But yeah, there is a version of it here that says that. Yeah, 140 BPM. Over 100. That's all it was never. That's an outlier of all of this stuff. But yeah. Look, isn't that just such an interesting story?
Oh.
A story like no other. A band like no other. A band that are still around in a way and still continuing to influence and do things that are also bizarre and pop up every now and again. But there you go. Yeah, I think it's just, they've always fascinated me. And when I realized, when I saw that Resident Advisor article, I was like, we should do something on the KLF because it's just so interesting.
Thank you so much for bringing them to the podcast, because I didn't know them. I'm now obsessed with them and I love them, and I'm gonna read I want to read their novel. Like, it's all happening.
Just like true provocateurs, pranksters, whatever you want to call them, but like really artists as well.
Yeah,
really creative people. I think Bill Drummond is such an interesting man. He spending time in his company as well, you're just like, this guy is mad.
Yeah.
But he's also so interesting, compelling, and so like, he has ideas. I think that the things, that kind of mind that he has, just allows him to make the things, the decisions that people wouldn't make normally, he makes them. And he found a collaborator in Jimmy Cauty to do that. And the two of them are on the same wavelength. While they maybe don't work together all the time, and like the documentary Who Killed the KLF says that, like, he's made Jimmy Cauty like make artwork on riot shields and stuff like that. They're always doing stuff. There's an entire pyramid they wanted to make out of people's ashes and all this kind of stuff. So it's still provocative, but it's definitely outside the box. And I think that's something that they have always tried to do. And I think, to be honest, there's a lot of great music there as well. Like, there is, like, some of it's terrible. Some of it is terrible. But those three main hits they had, man, they are like such good tracks. The 3 a.m. Eternal, obviously they are taking, you know, Public Enemy hip hop and trance and house music, and you can hear Two Unlimited in that. Like I said, Stock Aitken and Waterman's, one of their acts was Two Unlimited, so you can really hear where they're coming from, and I think it's still, some of it still stands up today.
Definitely.
And a truly visionary artist, and people who did their own thing, and that is so rare, and people who are completely in charge of their own music and career and can't blame anyone else for whatever happened with them, and they have to live with the consequences like that, as they have done. And just really, really interesting. That is our story of the KLF.
Great. Thank you so much, Niall.
If you liked what you heard on this podcast, patreon.com/909 is where you can directly support us and help us pay the bills, and also contribute and take part in a lovely 909 community on Discord as well, as we always discuss some lovely people there. We do meetups every now and again. We share albums that we like and gigs that we've been to. It's a lovely place on the internet, far away from ex-Twitter, where you can actually have nice discussions with people who won't shout at you all the time.
Yeah.
Because that's what I feel like that place has become more than anything else in the last few weeks. So,
oh yeah, I'm gone.
Yeah.
I'm done.
You are gone. Yeah, yeah. So I'm you're gone, on, so. What do you call it?
The Blue Sky. Sky.
Blue Sky's
nice.
Blue Sky, yeah.
I'm really enjoying it.
Early days of Twitter vibes for that, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite nice. Like, basically everyone has like between like 100 and 300 followers and just talking to each other, and it's nice. Yeah, you don't feel like someone's gonna attack you for saying the wrong thing or something. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
recommend it.
Yeah. There certainly is, if you want to join, a place for nuanced discussion, patreon.com/909 for the Discord.
Yeah, the Discord.
Playlists great. And all the usual live mixes and discounts. We've got some, the Indie Sleaze Night is coming up soon on the 29th of September. Gave out cheaper tickets for that on Patreon. All sorts of stuff. So look, we would appreciate your support. But also just tell people about this podcast as well. We'd always appreciate that. That was our episode on the KLF. Andrea, thank you so much for participating, and as ever. And yeah, we're going to be back next week with an interesting chat, perhaps. I won't spoil it just yet in case it falls through, but I think it's going to happen. We're going to chat to a very well-known pop music writer and a musician about their work and a particular topic as well. So more on that next week, so check back in for that. 909.com and everything, and all that stuff for 909 on every platform, essentially. Andrea, do you want to plug anything?
Not at the moment, no. Just go well.
Love that.
Look after yourselves. Look after each other.
Be well. Be well. Okay, everybody, be well. Go forth and
listen to the KLF, for God's sake.
Less ancient.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.